The governments in Britain and Israel are in the process of falling apart. President Trump has been to China, where he's been given a royal welcome by Xi Jinping. And as America continues to drown in debt, it gets a new Federal Reserve chairman. Can he save the American economy? We'll look at all this and more on today's Trump in World. President Trump held his long-awaited and long-delayed state visit to China this week. It went great. He signed a lot of great deals. What are those deals? Well, at least last time I checked, we don't really have much in the way of specifics. To understand what it all means as much as we can, we'll start with our Asia correspondent, Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, that's right. President Trump is in China right now meeting with Xi Jinping, and he has really played up these trade deals that he apparently made, although he's offered no specifics, and it does not appear that he's been able to influence Xi Jinping on the fentanyl precursors that are flowing into the U.S. or the systematic theft of U.S. Military technology and other various IP. Many of those matters don't appear to have been broached. And I think really the big story here is that throughout these meetings that President Trump held, the consistent message from China, or at least a major talking point, was that the pressure regarding Taiwan is ramping up a great deal. You know, he basically told President Trump, Xi Jinping told President Trump to essentially mind his own business and stop selling weapons to Taiwan and stop helping the Taiwanese prepare for China's takeover of this island, or else there will be, quote, clashes and conflicts. That's the language that Chinese Secretary General Xi Jinping used as he was speaking with President Trump. The full quote here that Xi Jinping said to Trump was, "The Taiwan question is the most important issue in China-U.S. relations. If it is handled properly, the bilateral relationship will enjoy overall stability. Otherwise, the two countries will have clashes and even conflicts, putting the entire relationship in great jeopardy." So those are quite heavy words from the Chinese leader there, quite a serious threat that he's issuing. And this comes after the Trump administration agreed to sell Taiwan an $11 billion arms package, just all kinds of military gear to help the Taiwanese build up their defenses to hopefully deter a Chinese invasion from ever happening, or to be more prepared to fight if the invasion does materialize. But that U.S. equipment has not yet been delivered to Taiwan, and Xi Jinping seems to think that he may be able to pressure President Trump into maybe canceling the sale. And China does have plenty of leverage. Mostly it's in the form of trade and, you know, promises to increasingly buy from and sell to the United States. But China also has leverage with its close relationship with Iran, which could have a big bearing on the Strait of Hormuz and other aspects of the Iran war. China is also, of course, Russia's number one partner, which means China could help influence Russia's war on Ukraine if it chose to, in a way that no other nation could. So China has an array of cards that it could play, and Xi Jinping seems to be willing to play them in any way that will help him to seize Taiwan. Seizing this island nation, it's really an obsession for Xi Jinping. He has staked his credibility as China's leader on his promise to assert Chinese control over Taiwan. And U.S. backing has really been the main force preventing that for these many years. So China watchers are keeping a close watch on President Trump's visit to China right now, just to see what specific deals Xi Jinping might offer Trump in exchange for America kind of letting go of Taiwan. And they're also watching, of course, to see whether President Trump would go for such a deal. And the trumpet has warned for some 25 years now that America's lack of resolve will end up being the main factor that will eventually enable China to absorb Taiwan. Back in 1998, Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry wrote about President Bill Clinton making a statement that basically opposed Taiwanese independence. In that article, Mr. Fleury called the Taiwanese people our freedom-loving friends. And he was very clear that America should support them. That was the right thing to do. Mr. Fleury made it very clear that that was morally the right thing to do. There was no, you know, pragmatic kind of isolationism in his view of the situation. He called the Taiwanese our freedom-loving friends. And it was just crystal clear that America should military support democracies, militarily support democracies such as Taiwan, and stand up to aggressors such as China. But Mr. Fleury said that Bill Clinton's statements at that time showed that Taiwan's days of freedom were numbered. He said that Taiwan would eventually be absorbed by China because of what he called, quote, a pitifully weak-willed America. His analysis in that article is built on biblical prophecy, especially a prophecy in Leviticus 26 showing that modern-day America would lose the will to really use its power. And we have a free booklet called Russia and China in Prophecy that covers the China-Taiwan dynamic. And it goes through everything that Mr. Fleury has said about this flashpoint. So for anyone who doesn't have a copy of Russia and China in Prophecy, I hope you'll go over to thetrumpet.com and order your free copy there so that you can really understand the high altitude context of this situation.
Thank you for that, Jeremiah. I think it's an important, interesting point from Donald Trump, where there are ways where he has stood up to China. I think most notably the Panama Canal. But then you have this trip where he's obviously not doing that in a lot of ways. And then this issue of Taiwan. I wanted to play a clip from Mr. Fleury, because like you say, he has talked about this for a very long time. But here, I think this is from a Key of David called China's Biggest Scandal Ever Against the U.S. And he focuses on the Panama Canal as being that biggest scandal, China's takeover of that canal, which Donald Trump has really pushed back on. But he brings Taiwan into that same conversation. Here's the clip.
Where is our vision? Where is our world vision? We're so wrapped up in ourselves, we don't often even see what is happening. And we've really forsaken little Taiwan, who used to be our foreign ally, but we didn't have the courage to stand with them. And so they're now under the control of China as well. But here, the thing that, this canal had everything to do with the security of the Western world, especially in the whole world in many ways. And we just gave it away, and now look what's happening to it. You know, somebody, some evil power would take over little Panama and do something like this. China did it, and nobody really seemed to care, not even our politicians and our leaders. We can change that, and we can have God's power on our side if we'll just look to God.
So I think that's an interesting quote, because you see where Donald Trump does have some vision. Like, he did have the vision to challenge China over Taiwan. And I think that fight's not over yet, and it might be premature to say, well, that's it, he's kicked them out. But certainly he's tried to break the canal away from the clutches of Chinese Communist Party owned businesses. I mean, really just out of the clutches of the Chinese Communist Party. But Mr. Fleury finishes there, and that was right at the end of the Key of David, talking about, well, ultimately we need to look to God. And so I think we see where some better vision from Donald Trump has improved some things. But really confronting China, you know, that requires some faith. Like, it's not a minor thing to really go kind of really toe-to-toe with China. For a U.S. president, someone who's democratically elected, to really duke it out with, even if you just keep it to economic war or conflict, not even physical war, but with the country that sells you most of your gadgets and electronics and trinkets, you're going to lose a lot of popularity doing that. So I think it would take a lot of courage and really faith to do that. And so, you know, we see Donald Trump, he'll go part of the way, but not really all the way, at least so far. And I think it's that lack of there's some better vision, but that lack of faith in God that explains some of that.
I think that's a great point. And I think that one thing that factors heavily into President Trump's thinking is what you could call spheres of influence. So he really feels that Taiwan is sort of inside China's sphere of influence and that maybe China should be allowed to control Taiwan. Similarly, he believes Ukraine is within Russia's sphere of influence and that maybe Russia should be given control of Ukraine. And then with the Panama Canal, it's the same thing. That's within America's sphere of influence, just a geographically, you know, connected, close area there. So it does seem like with something inside of America's sphere of influence, he does have quite a lot of will and a lot of resolve. And that's great to see that he has loosened China's grip on the Panama Canal and seems to be asserting, you know, American power over that once again. But that same sphere of influence mentality, I think, is not playing out well for some of these democracies around the world that happen to be close to some of the world's most vicious aggressors.
Yeah, I think it's a good point. And it also shows the danger of relying on worldly wisdom in a world full of beasts. And you can get some better outcomes for a while by playing global politics and things like that, but it's a dangerous game, and to really be secure, well, God is the only security for nations. I wanted to play another clip. This is from a later Key of David, where this was under Joe Biden, and Mr. Flurry really had it attacked America under Mr. Biden and under Mr. Obama because of the way that they'd softened their views on China due to economic incentives. That they were making a whole lot of money, and so they were going soft on China. And he talked about the book Secret Empires that exposed that. But I think it's worth remembering that as you see Donald Trump go to China and then soften his stance due to trade deals. Now, I don't think that President Trump is as personally corrupt as, say, the Biden family was. I mean, I might have questions about some people in his inner circle, but I very much doubt that he's softening his stance on China because he's being paid or because money's being funneled to him, in the same way that I think that was happening much more, in a much bigger way, for those around Joe Biden. But, this idea of short-sightedly, we're getting a lot of money, so we're handing everything to China, that is dangerous.
Now, the name of the book is Secret Empires, but China is accused of seeking out influential politicians and then making certain business deals with them and their extended family so they can make millions of dollars, but they have to soften their view of China. They can't have strong views against them, or they wouldn't make all those millions of dollars. Now, that is the accusation. That's his accusation, and he has a lot of facts to support that. But it's his view. If you look at today at China and how they control that South China Sea and a sea gate that goes through that area, they are able to almost totally control the flow of trade through that sea gate in that area, which amounts to about, I think it's about $5 trillion annually flowing through that area, which means China could absolutely wreck the economies of a lot of countries just by controlling that area. Now, what does it all mean? What do you think all this means? What is it all about? Well, surely, if we stop and think about this, with China doing all that and making all these deals and paying all that money, what is their goal? What is their ambition? Surely we must see a strong motivation there to, take over the world, to conquer the world, and some of the Chinese leaders will even tell you that. So add to that that China is allied with Russia, also a nuclear superpower. What does it mean if some of our politicians soften down the criticism of either one of those nations? I mean, surely that has to be an abominable thing to do, because look what their goal is and what their ambition is. If that is true, it's something that is really a terrible, terrible accusation against somebody in our own nation, some of its leaders. But you, instead of softening the view, when we see what's going on in Russia and China, we ought to be so horrified, we'll do anything to help raise the alarm and let the world see what is coming. This is a horrifying problem. And yet most people don't see it. You know why? Well, a big part of the reason is because, well, quite a lot of people have softened their views. And they ought to intensify them and raise the alarm to the very peak of their ability. But surely the superpowers of this size would be mentioned in your Bible. Surely they would be involved in biblical prophecy. And they are. And you can prove that, and we'll give you all kinds of information today to prove it to you.
And Mr. Flory, in that clip, he talks about, again, that Russia-China relationship that's very dangerous that you pointed to with that book, Russia and China in Prophecy, that has a lot more to say about Russia individually, China individually, and then that growing relationship. What else did you have for us from the Asian world, Jeremiah?
Yes, just one other story here about Russia's war on Ukraine. There was a partial ceasefire over the weekend to allow for Russia's Victory Day parade to take place there in Moscow. And following that, there was a bit of optimism that maybe this temporary ceasefire meant that this horrific war could finally be coming to an end. But then all of those hopes were dashed on Wednesday when Russia pummeled Ukraine's capital. And some other cities with 1,600 drones and missiles for 30 hours straight. So this attack on civilian targets has stretched into Thursday as well. And this was Russia's largest and longest aerial assault of the entire four-year war, four plus years now. And it totally destroyed the previous record of about 1,000 drones and missiles for one attack. So we learned that Russia had basically used that ceasefire time really to just stockpile more drones and missiles for this unprecedented attack. And the attack did accomplish Russia's goals of killing and injuring Ukrainian civilians. They managed to kill at least 15 people, and they injured more than 100, including several children. And this just gives us even more evidence showing that Vladimir Putin's Russia is not acting in any sort of pursuit of peace, and it continues to operate as a brutally aggressive and morally indefensible regime.
Thank you for that, Jeremiah. A major part of the reason why China is able to threaten America is the U.S. debt. And this is something that Mr. Flory has talked about directly in connection with China bringing down the United States. For example, here's a clip from his 2020 Key of David program, The China-America Clash is Prophesied.
China has tried ferociously to overtake the U.S. economy for years, and they've probably done so now. And also they have driven to overtake our modern science, and they've tried very hard to surpass us in that area as well, because science has a lot to do with the quality of your economy and how strong it is. That's an important area to them as well. And of course that has to do and relates to this coronavirus. But this crisis has cost the United States trillions of dollars. Our debt is soaring toward $30 trillion, if you can even imagine that. And one reporter said, and one commentator, this monster debt is going to assure that the United States is no longer a superpower. Now, that's a very sober forecast, but it's something we ought to consider.
So that debt is a key reason why China is able to threaten the United States. This week, we passed another important milestone on that debt. To hear more about it, we'll go to our U.S. correspondent, Andrew Miller.
Yeah, this week the public debt surpassed 100% of GDP for the first time since World War II. Now, some of you may be a little confused when you hear that. Like, wasn't the debt already over 100% of GDP? And like, yes, that is true. The total debt passed 100% of GDP back in 2012. But these the way they count the numbers is there's several types of debt the United States has taken on. The public debt, that's what just passed 100% of GDP, is the amount of money the U.S. government owes to outside investors, whether they be foreign governments, foreign investors, or American citizens who bought treasury bonds. The total debt includes another factor, which is the amount of money the government owes to itself. That's basically money that, it's mainly money the government's taken from their Social Security program in order to buy things. So it's still a legitimate debt in that it's promised retirees money. And so if it takes money from the Social Security program, it does have to put it back in order to uphold its retirement obligations. But it's the total debt's not as significant in terms of like looking at impending U.S. bankruptcy, just because if you renege on a debt to you that you owe yourself, your creditor is more likely to forgive you, since your creditor is also yourself, to whereas the debt you owe to foreigners has much more to do with your like financial solvency. So either way, it's the U.S. GDP is roughly $31 trillion. So that's the amount of debt. Like the United States government, we owe about $40 trillion total, but about $9 trillion of it is money we've taken from Social Security and other accounts. So we owe about $31 trillion to outside investors. So astronomical amounts of debt either way, which is going to be a major problem for America going forward. We had another spotlight on this week in that we've got a new Federal Reserve chairman. Kevin Warsh just took over as the 17th chairman for the Federal Reserve. And this is going to be interesting to watch because basically for the first 2 years of his administration, President Trump has been saying that any economic problems in America are the fault of the Federal Reserve Chair, Jerome Powell, particularly his refusal to cut interest rates. He's like, it's too much for Americans to borrow money. So he's been waiting to get Jerome Powell out of office and get someone else in who will cut interest rates. And he's hoping that person is going to be Kevin Warsh. And so now as we see the moves Warsh starts making, I think more people are going to realize that America's debt has put us in a compromising situation to which there are no easy solutions. Actually, some of the mainstream media sources reporting on this are saying basically Kevin Warsh is inheriting a challenge that basically no Federal Reserve chair has faced since World War II. And that challenge is specifically the fact that for the first time since World War II, the U.S. public debt is more than GDP is.
Yeah, I think that's a good point about Warsh. Like, I think he's got a lot of good sound thinking, but when you've got such a mess as this, you know, there's a point of no return, or you can get to points where it's certainly impossible to get out of this without significant amounts of pain. And if we look at what Warsh has written in the past, yeah, he might be willing to lower interest rates, but he's also very focused on all of the other massive Federal Reserve program that we've seen over the last 15 years or so, quantitative easing, where America has created all of this money. And his kind of philosophy is, okay, let's lower interest rates, but at the same time, let's aggressively essentially destroy all of the money that we have printed through quantitative easing. Let's make instead of having the metaphorical printing presses going, let's have metaphorical bonfires lit, destroying all of this money that we've printed. And that way we can keep inflation under control while at the same time cutting interest rates, which I don't know. Who knows how that will work or not, but most of this money that was printed, that was created from nothing, was used to buy US Treasury bonds, was used to loan to the US government. So like you're saying, the US government has this massive appetite for debt. Walsh comes along and not only has the Federal Reserve not print money and loan it to the government, but actually kind of competes with the government by selling government debt while America is also trying to sell new government debt. And you could very quickly have a hard time trying to fund the US government, or even if the Federal Reserve is cutting interest rates don't go down because the US government still has to offer high rates of interest to persuade people to loan it money.
Right. I'll be curious to see how this plays out, because I feel like this is Donald Trump's big economic blind spot. Whether he really doesn't know this or he's just pretending he doesn't know this for political reasons is up for debate. But he's blaming everything on low interest rates right now, and not blaming anything on government spending, when the fact of the matter is the government's, it's pushing like $1.8, $2 trillion deficits right now. So it's basically borrowing $2 trillion from investors and then using it to buy stuff. So it's pumping that $2 trillion into circulation. And just common sense should tell you that the more dollars there are, the less each individual dollar is worth. So because the US government's pumping these trillions of dollars of deficit spending into the economy, it's creating inflation. Inflation that got up to 9% under Biden because the government actually during COVID spent $6 trillion. And so in order to bring that inflation down without cutting government spending, this is what Jerome Powell did, is he just raised interest rates really high so that as the government pumped the money into the economy and created inflation, individual investors would see that because there's high interest rates, they took that money and put it into like long-term investments and savings accounts. So Donald Trump was like, well, now it's so expensive to borrow money, people can't get loans to start businesses, and we're like pushing it towards recession. You've got to cut these interest rates to stimulate the economy. But of course, if he did that, inflation would come right back. So you've got a situation where you've got high government spending, low inflation, low interest rates. Please pick two. You can't spend $2 trillion you don't have in government spending, keep inflation at 2%, and have interest rates at zero. There's economic laws that are as constant as the laws of physics that prevent that. And I believe actually $1 in $5 in circulation has been put into circulation since COVID. They've done that much quantitative easing in the past 5 years. That 20% of the money in circulation was created out of nothing since the COVID pandemic. So yeah, Kevin Walsh is saying that, like, well, if we start actually don't do what Jerome Powell did and pull that money out of circulation by raising interest rates and putting it in investments, but actually start destroying that money, shrinking the money supply, then that would exert a low pressure on inflation while the interest rates remain low. And it's like he's juggling. It's a very balancing act with many moving pieces. And I don't think I've actually seen a Federal Reserve chair ever take that strategy where he's like, well, I want the inflation to be low, I want the interest rates to be low, I want the government to be able to spend as much money as it wants, So we've actually got to start destroying money after it's put into circulation. I don't think it's a good long-term solution, but it might help. But again, circling back to the beginning, the big problem here is the deficit spending. He is facing a situation no Federal Reserve Chair has faced since World War II, where the fact that we actually, the debt's bigger than the economy is. And there's no plan to reduce the size of the national debt. I think the last time I crunched the numbers, the economy is growing at like 3% a year and the national debt's growing at like 5% a year. So that debt to GDP ratio is just going to keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. I don't know exactly when the whole thing's going to come crashing down on us, but it's like Warren Buffett says in regards to the debt to GDP ratio. If something can't go on forever, it will stop. So at some point, the debt to GDP ratio gets so big that like you will be facing bankruptcy. Some economists say that they think when the debt to GDP ratio gets to 200%, it just passed 100%. Once it gets to 200%, the whole thing will crash down. It might come substantially before then. But you can also get to 200% pretty quickly, because you get a snowball effect that when you get to a certain point when nations stop trusting your ability to pay back the debt, they start demanding higher interest rates, which then makes your national debt start going up exponentially.
Well, thank you for that, Andrew. And we can know through cause and effect that America is heading for a financial crisis just through that logical analysis that you've presented. We also know, however, from Bible prophecy, there are specific prophecies about what the crash that's coming, what it looks like. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, there's actually one thing that I will point to first. I'm going to point to two things. Is just the blessings and cursings chapters, Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28. That tell you the blessings that come on a nation when they obey and the curses that come when you disobey. But that same chapter in Leviticus 26, it also talks about if you obey God, you'll lend money to other people and other people will not lend money to you, which means you're a net creditor. And you actually have political power over other nations because of the fact that they owe you money. But on the flip side, it says that if you disobey God, then foreigners will lend to you and you will not lend to them. So some basic math here. If someone lends you money and you don't lend them any money, you're a net debtor. That's how you become a net debtor. If the amount of money you owe is greater than the amount of money other people owe you, you're a net debtor. And God says that in Leviticus 26, that's a curse that comes on a nation. So the fact that we're a net debtor nation, you'll hear some like fancy pants economic professors get up and explain why debt is good and leverage is good and where you need like grow your debt to grow your wealth. And I'm not saying it's always wrong to take on a modest debt that you've got a plan to pay back. But the Bible standpoint here is that definitely if you're a net debtor nation, that is not a blessing. That is a curse. Other Bible verses in Proverbs even say that like the borrower is servant to the lender, it says in the King James. And I actually think that word for servant could even be translated as slave. So the borrower is slave to the lender. So America is making itself slaves to other nations by owing them these $31 trillion. So that's a very direct prophecy from the Bible about the national debt. There's also like a second tier or more indirect prophecy about national debt that Herbert W. Armstrong made. and our Mr. Gerald Flory has called this his greatest personal prophecy. A personal prophecy is not something that's directly in the Bible, but it's a prediction that's still very based on Bible prophecy. The second tier of personal prophecy Mr. Armstrong has made is that a financial crisis in the United States would be the catalyst that prompts the Holy Roman Empire to reunite. Now, we call that a personal prophecy because there's a direct prophecy in Revelation 17 about 10 nations in Europe uniting into a European superpower. And there's many other direct prophecies in the Old Testament, like Isaiah 10:5 and others, about that revived Holy Roman Empire conquering America. So the personal prophecy Mr. Armstrong made is that because the European Union started as a fiscal union, and they're trying to proceed towards monetary union and won't do it because even though the nations of Europe have been willing to give up control over interest rates to the European Central Bank, they've been reluctant to give up control over their tax policy. It makes sense that it would take a global financial crisis precipitated by the breakdown of the American financial system that would give those nations the last push they need to unite into a superpower with the military ability to take down the United States. And so between those two prophecies, the direct one in Leviticus about you're going to be a net debtor if you disobey me, and then like the second tier one, that prediction that Mr. Armstrong made that it looks like the collapse of the American financial system will be the catalyst causing these more direct prophecies about the Holy Roman Empire to rise. You can definitely say that the situation Kevin Warsh is facing right now is very prophetic, to where there's no good options because we're a net debtor nation. And he has some creative ideas to kick the bucket down the road. And maybe we'll kick the bucket down the road a little bit. But it's not solving the core problem.
Great. Well, thank you for that. Andrew, what else do you have for us from the Anglo-America region?
Yeah, three quick stories. One here just highlighting growing political division in the United States is that the Supreme Court of Virginia, not the Supreme Court of the nation, but the Supreme Court of Virginia has struck down a Democratic Party plan to redraw Virginia's voting districts. The Democratic Party in Virginia wanted to redraw the districts so that basically all the Republicans in Virginia were just in one of 11 districts, which means that even though about 45% of the people in Virginia are Republicans, if you pack them all into one district, they only get 9% of the seats in the Virginia legislature. So really unfair decision that tries to basically reduce 45% of Virginia's population down to 9% of its voting power just because they happen to be conservative. In order to get this map through, they had to break several of the several laws and policies about how to do redistricting, which is why the Supreme Court of Virginia struck it down. But it definitely highlights a bigger story of just how legal lawfare between the two political parties is getting worse. Something the Bible says will eventually, this lawfare will leave the courtroom and actually escalate into full-scale civil warfare as elections come by. Because there's stories in many other states, Louisiana and California, about like these gerrymandering wars that are going on in the United States. Another one, circling back to our big story of the day about just China's influence over America, is that there was the mayor of Arcadia, California, Elaine Wang, she resigned this week, basically after it was exposed that she was working as a spy or a secret agent for the People's Party of China. Always shocking when you've got like a mayor of a U.S. city you find working for the Chinese Communist Party. But that's a topic that when you dig into it a little more, you find out there's mayors, there's politicians, there's scientists, there's professors, police officers. There's all sectors of U.S. government are having direct influence from the People's Republic of China. As you bring just more and more spies over here to just make sure that America is spending its strength in vain. And then for the last one, another story on media bias, particularly how the New York Times is publishing what really amounts to blood libel against Israel, making claims about how they're treating the Palestinians and how they're conducting genocide in Gaza that have been widely debunked even by mainstream sources. And yet this institution, the New York Times, which is so controlled by the radical left that they're making these claims for political purposes anyway. So we've got an article up on the website, went up about that this week, just really showing how what can only be counted as like treasonous bias in America's media, making sure that the American people don't actually know what's happening in their world as they push forward things that are blatant lies in service of a political agenda.
Thank you for that, Andrew. Britain and Israel are both in the process of having their governments fall apart. We'll start with Israel in the Middle East and get an update from Mihailo Zekic.
Yes, on May 12th, Degel HaTorah, which is an ultra-Orthodox interest party, announced, or rather their spiritual leader, the rabbi that basically influences the movement, announced that they no longer support the governing coalition of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and that the opposition parties should work to, quote, dissolve the Knesset as soon as possible. Now, Degel HaTorah used to be a member of the coalition. They left, but because of them leaving, the government is basically split in the Knesset between 60 seats for the government and 60 seats for the opposition in the 120-seat body. The main reason that it's this party in particular that's causing this turmoil is because to this point, since Israel's founding, yeshiva students, members of the ultra-Orthodox religious factions were exempt from the military draft because a lot of Israelis see it unfair that all their sons and daughters are getting sent to Gaza and Lebanon, but these guys are exempt. They've been pushing to include them in the draft. It's been an informal exemption. Israel has just ignored drafting them. And at this point, the courts have ruled that Israel can't do that anymore. And Netanyahu's stuck trying to please the courts and trying to please his coalition partners. And in the end, nobody's happy. But the big story from this is that this pressure, instead of letting the opposition parties take the first step and dissolve the Knesset on their initiative, the very next day, Netanyahu's Likud party announced or submitted a bill to dissolve the Knesset on their terms. The bill still has to be voted on formally next week, but if the government is supporting this, it's all but guaranteed to happen. So this means once it's passed that Israel will have to have elections within 5 months, and 2026 was going to be an election year per their election cycles anyway. They were going to have one in late October at the latest, but it could happen a lot earlier now. And the opposition has not just this one smaller party, but the entire opposition has been egging on for something like this to happen for quite some time. We spoke about on this program before about how two of the most prominent opposition candidates, former prime ministers Naftali Bennett and Yair Lapid, have combined their parties into one super bloc and trying to encourage other popular opposition candidates to get behind them as well, to unify the opposition and present a united front against Netanyahu in this election. Now, just because Netanyahu himself would decide when this election is going to happen, just because he still has some power as prime minister, that doesn't mean that he's coming in this from a position of strength. There is polling suggesting that at least Bennett's bloc could have a chance of getting first place in a hypothetical election and being first in line to try and form a government. But either way, a lot of intrigue and twists and turns happening in Israeli politics.
So is Netanyahu likely to survive, or is this, and he has been the great survivor, is this the end of his time in office?
I suspect this very well could be the end of the Netanyahu political movement as we know it. He was obviously voted out once before in 2021 by Naftali Bennett, and he regained the premiership soon after that. Back then, there wasn't the cloud of October 7th and all the security failures hanging over the government like it is now. And also, there hasn't been the issue of, okay, we fought the war. Hamas is still in Gaza. You told us we were going to have victory. We haven't seen victory. You told us that you get along very well with President Donald Trump. We've seen a lot of evidence to the contrary of that. And also, there is also simple voter fatigue at this point. Aside from that brief blip starting in 2021, Netanyahu has been Israel's leader since 2009. Following a smaller stint as prime minister back in the 1990s, he's 76 years old. There's a lot of people, even among people that would normally side with him on many issues, that feel he's just stuck around far too long than is ideal in a normal democracy. He has a lot of personal interest in trying to keep himself in power, even if he isn't, say, guilty in some of these smears of him in his corruption trials. It's time for Israel to move on and stop letting the government be BB's sandbox. Which is why somebody like Bennett is very interesting to watch, because to this point, most of Netanyahu's challengers have come from the political left. And because of a lot of security crises Israel has faced, because of a lot of demonization from the international left, most Israelis, I think it's safe to say, are right-wing, or at least have more right-wing opinions than in some issues than most of the rest of the world. Bennett comes from the political right, and his stance is not so much we want to be soft on security, we want to kowtow to the rest of the world, but it's more, I'm going to give you everything Netanyahu promised and do it much better. And because of that, he has a greater chance, I feel, of siphoning off a lot of these more traditional voting blocs that have supported Netanyahu throughout the years.
So without this kerfuffle, and I guess he would have had to have an election by October anyway. So we're looking at something that does move up the timetable, but only by a couple of months. But you know, with Netanyahu's survival on the line, you know, this is an individual that that Mr. Flurry has written a lot about. He was on the front cover of our August 2025 Trumpet print edition with the article Netanyahu, Israel's Rising Lion. What does this election mean prophetically for Israel?
Well, depending on how circumstances come out, if Netanyahu ends up leaving office, we speak all the time on this show about prophecies in places like Hosea 5:13, Zechariah 14 verses 1 to 2, about crises that are going to hit the state of Israel from all sides, especially in the realm of security and dealing with the problem with the Palestinians. October 7th is proof that these curses are coming regardless of who is in power, but Netanyahu's strong leadership has done a lot to push back on some of these attacks, not just from a terrorism perspective, but even, again, standing up to the international community, going ahead with keeping Israel safe regardless of, say, the International Criminal Court warrants or a lot of these other attacks that probably many other leaders would have buckled under far earlier. We've spoken about on this program before about people like Bennett. Okay, maybe they have some overlap with what Netanyahu stands for, but in Bennett's case, he is very unprincipled. The reason he got into power in the first place was because he made an alliance with Yair Lapid, which his entire voting platform was he would never, ever do that, and he's doing it again. And losing somebody of Netanyahu's caliber, even putting in a completely different political party with different political backers into the power in the Knesset, would probably put Israel's new leadership in, or would give a lot of their stakeholders leverage over the, over this new leadership in turning away from some of these programs Netanyahu has been focusing on, like doubling down on the West Bank, like not giving independence to the Palestinians. That isn't to say that this is the only scenario this can take place in. As I mentioned, even if Netanyahu stays in power, we still expect curses in this realm to be hitting Israel. But if this is the scenario that plays out, and there is a decent chance that this could happen, then these prophecies, like in Hosea, like in Zechariah, would be accelerated. And our free booklet by Mr. Fleury, Jerusalem and Prophecy, goes into more of those details.
Great. Well, thank you for that, Mihailo. An important story. I mean, Benjamin Netanyahu has been I think, such an impressive leader in the way that he has very boldly stood up for Israel in the face of global condemnation. So how that plays out will be very interesting, very important to watch. What else do you have for us from the Middle East?
A couple of stories. On May 14th, Lebanon confirmed that they sent a letter last month to the United Nations accusing Iran of various serious charges like meddling in Lebanon's internal affairs, dragging Lebanon into a war with Israel that they didn't want to go into, violating diplomatic protocol. Okay, I guess every major power does this and every smaller country in their sphere of influence, but what is interesting is that for years and years, Lebanon has been a proxy of Iran through Hezbollah. And the Lebanese government, even if they didn't support what Hezbollah was doing, even if they weren't behind Hezbollah's vision, they were powerless enough to never mind just do anything about it, but even say anything about it. The fact that they're able to make such a big stance at a public forum like the UN like this, essentially declaring, we're not friends with Iran, we don't want to be friends with Iran, Iran, stop trying to pressure us into your camp, go back home, is extremely noteworthy. And putting that on top of a lot of other moves the new Lebanese government has made, like openly talking about a peace treaty with Israel. That is unprecedented, and if Iran had the same leverage it used to have not that long ago in Lebanon, even that kind of talk would have never happened. So regardless of what this piece of paper in the UN can accomplish, pieces of paper in the UN generally are famous for accomplishing nothing, but the fact that Lebanon is willing to openly state this, openly defy Iran for the world to see, shows that they're prepared to never be a part of Iran's so-called axis of resistance again. And that ties in with the prophecy in Psalm 83, which speaks of Lebanon being in alliance with Europe against Iran, which we've spoken about many times on this program. And then one last story, speaking of Israel and the Palestinians, this week Axios reported that the Board of Peace, U.S. President Donald Trump's international body meant to put Gaza together again after the war, is moving forward with its program on sending money in to reconstruct Gaza, on inaugurating the new government, on inaugurating a new police force, but only in the places that Israel controls Gaza. Strictly speaking, this whole program was only supposed to happen after Hamas fulfills its obligations under President Trump's program of disarming, of basically dissolving itself as a political entity, of allowing the Board of Peace to come in and take over its slivers of territory. If anybody's been paying attention to the news from the Middle East for a while, they know that Hamas is not disarmed. Hamas has not given up its territory. Hamas has not even pretended to agree to that anymore. And the fact that you're seeing the Board of Peace move forward in this way now shows that they don't really have a plan to disarm Hamas. They don't really have a plan to force Hamas to agree to these terms. They're essentially admitting they don't have any leverage over Hamas. And when the ceasefire originally was announced, when President Trump was making all these big overtures about how peace is finally coming to the Middle East, we at the Trumpet were saying this deal's not going to bring peace. This the problems in Gaza are going to continue. Over 6 months later now, we could definitely see that even some of these people that President Trump has put over to implement these plans, they're admitting that too, at least tacitly.
Well, thank you for that, Mihailo. I also mentioned Britain having its share of leadership turmoil, and we've now reached the position where Keir Starmer seems set to be on the way out, but it's going to take us a couple of months to find out who his successor is, or even to be sure he will be going. So it looks like Britain is now all set to spend the summer in limbo with a lot of uncertainty as to who is going to be running the country in the longer term, which, you know, it makes it very hard for anyone to do anything of significance. What can Sir Keir Starmer do even as Prime Minister with that job if people think he might be gone in a week or two or a month or two? So welcome to a Britain now stuck in limbo going forward. So here's the situation. We had the local elections last week. We spoke about that on the show. It was a terrible result for the Labour Party. So going into this week, there was a lot of pressure on Keir Starmer to step down. He decided not to. The reports from the press is that he was going to, but then one of his cabinet ministers, his Home Secretary, kind of went public in saying, hey, we're all trying to pressure him to step down. And at that point, he didn't want to look like he'd been forced out or hounded out. So he got a lot more stubborn and said, no, you're going to, if you're going to get rid of me, you're going to have to do it the hard way. I'm not going to fall on my sword here. That then, well, then going forwards from that, we have two leading candidates that are leading at the moment to replace Starmer from within the Labour Party. It's not necessarily going to be one of those two. The people that start off leading candidates don't always finish as leading candidates, but the Labour Party hold the majority of seats in Parliament. Whoever leads the Parliamentary Labour Party holds that job of Prime Minister because they can get a majority in Parliament. So the Labour Party can change the Prime Minister without holding fresh elections. They just need to select a new Prime Minister. We saw this happen several times under the Conservatives. And the process of selecting a leader, that's set by the party. So the Labour Party have a different process for selecting a leader than the Conservative Party did. So now who's going to be Prime Minister depends on what the Labour Party does and with their selection process. So you've got two key challenges. On the one hand is now former Health Secretary Wes Streeting. He is from, say, more the centrist Labour Party. He's considered a bit more right-wing, and the Labour Party is Britain's equivalent of the Democrats. It's a left-wing party, but he's considered more of a centrist. He is a homosexual, so he would be Britain's first homosexual prime minister after we've had our first Catholic prime minister, our first Hindu prime minister. We're getting a Britain that is more and more unmoored from its roots. But he is the leading candidate right now for kind of the more right-wing, pro-business wing of the party. And again, of a socialist party. So, you know, he's not a right-wing figure by any means. His main rival is the mayor of Greater Manchester, Andy Burnham, who has basically been on different wings of the Labour Party at different sides. He was a Blairite under Tony Blair, a Brownite under Gordon Brown, a Corbynista under Jeremy Corbyn. Right now, he is on the left wing of the party, and he's kind of their candidate. And the big complicating factor is he is not in Parliament yet, so he's not eligible to lead the Labour Party. That's the situation. To get rid of Sir Keir Starmer, the Labour Party has to get 80 votes, 80 MPs have to pick someone else. And then that person and anyone else that meets that 80, or actually it's 81 threshold, will go in an election with the wider Labour Party, you know, the rank and file members, as well as trade union members, you know, thousands, millions of people up and down the country. Keir Starmer would automatically be on that ballot as well, unless he resigns. And whoever gets the most votes wins. But before all that can take place, the Labour Party's decided to put all of that on pause to see if Andy Burnham can get a seat. So one MP for a region in Manchester has stepped down to allow Andy Burnham to run for Parliament so he can have an opportunity to stand in that election. In this seat, the Reform Party are doing really well. So Nigel Farage says they're going to throw the kitchen sink at it, and they do have a prospect of beating him and denying him that seat, in which case the left would have to rally around a different candidate, maybe Angela Rayner or Ed Miliband. My point here with all of this is it is a pretty complex, involved process. And so we're going to have, so MPs resigned, we're going to have a by-election. That's going to take weeks. And people thought, well, Wes Streeting might try and launch a quick coup. He's decided, well, if I really want to lead the Labour Party, you know, I can't kind of get the job on a technicality. Either he doesn't have the 80 seats, or he's saying, well, we're going to let Burnham get in before I fire the starting gun on this. So we're going to wait and see what happens with Andy Burnham. After that, there'd be another leadership election. That's going to take several weeks. So and potentially at the end of this, Keir Starmer could still win if he decides to run. So months of limbo, months of trying to work out who is going to be leading Britain. And maybe by the end of summer or September, we might have an answer as to who our prime minister is. And this is a country that used to be very stable in prime ministers. And now we've had five over the last 10 years. You know, we're averaging getting rid of one every couple of years. It's very clear that we have a leadership crisis in this country. And this just brings, and this is a curse that God promised if we disobeyed him. It's cause and effect, our own educational policies, family policies, turning against our own culture and traditions and those things that came from the Bible are producing a character crisis that produces a leadership crisis. And God curses us with this, that we don't have credible leaders. In Isaiah 3 and verse 12 in the New Living Translation says, "Oh, my people, your leaders mislead you. They send you down the wrong road." And that is exactly where we are today. Hosea 5 talks about the priests and the house of the king, you know, the leaders of the nation. It says they're a snare, they're a net. The leaders are a trap. Our way of life has brought us to this point where we can't govern ourselves. And the economic problems, the social problems are just too big. And so we've got leader after leader after leader. You know, like Isaiah 3 talks about, where people don't even want to be in charge. Well, you have clothes, you be our leader. And we just keep trying different people and it can't work. I think the other part of this that really stands out to me is we've had a succession of leaders that I think don't really believe in anything more than they want the job. Like they're standing to be prime minister and they'll say they'll believe anything that gets them that job. I think we pretty much since Margaret Thatcher, that's been the way it's been. Tony Blair, I think he had a vision. I think he was one of the, he had a vision that was much more radically left wing for the country than what he let on. And so he presented a different face to the public, to the media, and stayed in power for many years working away at that vision and shifted Britain dramatically to the left. So much as I disagree with that vision and what he stood for, I guess at least he had some kind of a vision. But Margaret Thatcher, certainly a vision that she would stand for uncompromisingly. But since then, we've just had leaders that don't really believe in anything beyond where we want to be in power. And then they get in power and it's like, well, what do you want to do? I don't know. I don't have any ideas on how to fix the situation. And it's a powerful warning to cease from looking to man to solve our problems. I mean, that's what God says in Hosea, cease from man. We have caused our own problems. And the solution is repentance and getting back to God's law and that outlines a way of life that does produce strong leaders founded on a faith and a belief in God. And I have an article from a couple of years ago, What Happened to British Leadership, that maybe we'll need to update as we see everything fall apart. And the other major story I wanted to bring from Europe is an interesting story that happened over the weekend. We had the Russia celebrating its victory in Europe Day. Victory over Nazi Germany. We saw the parades going through Moscow, much more subdued than previously. And during all of that, we had Vladimir Putin suggest negotiating with Europe. Let's end the Iraq, let's end the Ukraine war, and we'll move forwards with a settlement and with something that creates a new reality, a new relationship, not just in Ukraine, but between Russia and Europe. He has made, I think this was the most direct appeal we've seen for him to Europe, but he's made those kind of statements before. But then he's not been willing to make the kind of concessions that Ukraine wants, and so the war drags on. What caught my eye, and what caught the eye of a lot of commentators, is he suggested a negotiator, an intermediary this time, his old friend, former German Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder. George Friedman said that the statement, whether or not Putin got his way, indicates something very important. He said Putin wants to return to the period in which Russia seemed to be preparing for a role within the European system. He also talked about, Friedman did in this article, that because of this costly war in Ukraine, the relationship between Europe, specifically NATO, and the US has deteriorated to a point where a new geopolitical system must emerge. I mean, really, by saying, hey, let's negotiate and let's have Gerhard Schroeder, the former German prime minister, chancellor who negotiated the Nord Stream pipelines, who played this crucial role in setting up this German-Russian relationship. He's saying, hey, Europe, you know, I've heard what you've been saying about Donald Trump and about NATO being over and you being fed up of this relationship with America. Well, you know, if you're really fed up with America, we can help you. I can help you make a clean break very quickly. You know, the choice of Schroeder as someone to appeal to as an intermediary is a message in and of itself. Mr. Gerald Fleury has drawn a lot of attention to the role that Gerhard Schroeder has played. I mean, he talked about the pipeline negotiating that went on between Schroeder and Putin. He said the fact that these two are working so closely together strongly indicates that they agree on a plan to destroy NATO. So Vladimir Putin is saying, let's get that plan back on track. Now, some in the German government, or the German government, initially rejected having Schroeder negotiate, but the Social Democrats, part of the ruling coalition, they said they're open to this. And then a rumor started spreading around that they would have Schroeder as an intermediary, but he'd also be joined by former Foreign Minister Frank-Walter Steinmeier as kind of a counterbalance. We'll see how it goes. But you see Putin reaching out and saying, all right, let's make this public break with America. Let's get Schroeder back leading the relationship between Germany and Europe. This is a critical relationship to watch for. And you can read more about that in Mr. Flurry's article, Germany and Russia's Secret War Against America. That's an important story to watch. You know, I think they've already done deals. And sooner or later, you'll have this public switching of sides, where Germany will say, we're done with NATO, we're allying with Putin. We've already replaced from Europe those things that we can, that we relied on America for, and those things that we can't do ourselves. Well, we've got a deal with Russia to get a hold of those things. I was talking on Wednesday's show. We had an expert from the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute come and talk about the arms industry, give a really detailed look at the arms industry. It was a fascinating discussion. But he talked about the difficulties in building up an arms industry from scratch and what Europe has to overcome. And I think that's part of the role that Putin can play. Hey, you want to be independent from America? We can make that happen very fast. So watch for that. That's something Herbert W. Armstrong warned about. That's something that Mr. Flurry has warned about. This is going to help Europe turn on America very, very quickly. And a lot of people just kind of take it for granted. Oh, it's going to take years, decades for Europe to build, to be independent from America. But work with Putin, they can turn against America very fast. And that's what Bible prophecy says will happen. They'll turn against America very quickly. Time is much more urgent than I think we tend to think it is. So you can read that article, Germany and Russia's Secret War Against America. Well, that is about all that we have time for. Thank you very much for joining us. Thank you to George Haddad and Victor Granados for engineering and production, as well as to all of our panelists today. If you have any questions, if you want to get in touch, you can email us trumpetworld@thetrumpet.com. On Wednesday, we have Philip Nice, the Trumpet Magazine Assistant Managing Editor, will be talking about our latest Trumpet print edition with Project Artemis and the return to the moon on the front cover. Lift up your eyes being the tagline there. Join us next Wednesday, and until then, keep watching your world.